Hey, Charles.
Hey, man, how are you?
I'm good, I'm good.
Great, nice shirt.
Yes.
All right, so what's going
on? Show the love, man.
It is. Lang.next.
Yes. So today we have here John Cook. John Cook has the most amazing blog. I think this is the best blog on the whole web or in the whole world, in the whole universe. And what I find so fascinating is that he kind of combines, you know, math with computer science and statistics and everything. So it's like every day I kind of go to my Outlook to see, you know, if there's a new blog entry in his blog. So can you tell us a little bit about your background and, you know, what drives you to kind of, you know, write such interesting things?
Oh, sure. Okay, so I've kind of had three different careers. I started out doing math, taught math for a while. Then I left academia, worked as a programmer, and then I sort of came full circle managing programming at MD Anderson. So sort of back in academia, still in software development.
So and so one of the things that I kind of realized, you know, as I've been in the programming language space now for so long, is that there's a new kind of math that has kind of sneaked up on me, you know, all this kind of machine learning and statistics. Yeah. Like if I look back 10, 15 years, that was like a fringe, but now that's kind of, you know, super mainstream. How did that happen?
How did that happen?
And why did that happen?
Okay, maybe also, one thing that happened in my field, Bayesian statistics, was that around 1980, statisticians discovered something physicists had discovered in the 50s, and that was MCMC. So this is an algorithm that makes possible evaluating things that weren't possible before, or wasn't practical. So before, people said, yeah, Bayesian statistics is real nice in theory, but you can't actually compute anything, so it's not practical. Well, so they discovered new algorithms in the 80s, and Moore's Law, and so now the objection is, well, it's, you know, it's hard to compute, just doesn't, you know, it's not so much of a showstopper anymore.
But one of the things is it also that, like, in old-fashioned computing, we were used to getting exact answers. And maybe as computer scientists, we were always afraid of, you know, this kind of, you know, probabilistic algorithms, because, sure, you know, they didn't give us the real answer. But now, maybe because of that everybody does search, is maybe there's like, you know, implicitly we some kind of fear fell off our backs and we're now more accepting of these kinds of things, or?
Right. One, I think even if you have an algorithm that is deterministic in theory, it may not be deterministic in practice. And, you know, hardware fails and so forth. And so I guess people have said, well, you know, that ship has sailed. Things are not deterministic, even if we want them to be, so we might as well open up the possibilities some more.
So another thing that you're kind of, you know, writing a lot about is this language R, and you're going to speak about this as well. What is R?
Okay, R is an open source statistical language. It's very popular in statistical research, not so much routine statistical analysis. There's existing software for doing traditional kinds of things. But when people are doing new software development in statistics, new algorithm development, a lot of times it's in R.
And so what is the kind of, you know, the magic in R that attracts people? because, you know, there's like many other people have like libraries in Python and, you know, maybe like Mathematica or Maple or how does R kind of suddenly kind of rise to the top there?
That's a good question. there's some things that R does well that I think people sort of imprint on R, maybe in grad school. They learn R simultaneously as they're learning their statistics. And like I said, it's very good for some things, but then people continue to use R for things it's not well suited for, and that's sort of the bane of my job right now is dealing with R code that was written, something written in R where something else would have been more appropriate. So, but as far as, you know, where it shines, it gives you very convenient data manipulation, has succinct notation for filtering and sorting data, very succinct notation for fitting regression models, sort of the things that people do day in and day out in statistics, it accommodates that well.
But is that part of the language, or are those kind of libraries? So kind of could I, for example, could I take those libraries and use them from C Sharp, or am I kind of, you know, is that very much tied into the syntax of the language? Or?
It is tied into the language, but you could always fake it somewhere else. Just like regular expressions are baked into Perl.
Yep.
That doesn't mean other languages can't use Perl, but they're slightly less convenient to use elsewhere. Yep. So like R has this very succinct notation for regression that is, there's no quotation marks, it's just built into the language. You could support that same notation in another language as a quoted string.
Yeah, and another thing is that in R, the kind of the notion of vector and so on is kind of, you know, deeply embedded. And whereas in other languages, usually, you know, that kind of is a burden because, you know, it's not like a base type. Is that something that you think is important?
Yes, I mean, for when you have an interpreted language that's dealing with a lot of vectors, then for efficiency reasons, it's nice to use the vector notation. And it can be very succinct. So that's, you know, like I said, convenient syntax for filtering and so forth. The downside of that is R actually has nothing but vectors. There's no double type. Or, I mean, in a sense there is, but you have to assume everything is a vector. So for better or for worse, everything's a vector.
So one of the things that I always kind of wonder when I look at these things, because I like to generalize things. So when I look at a vector, really, what's the difference between a vector and a class or, you know, struct with, you know, instead of positional values, it has named fields. So is there... My feeling is that we're maybe artificially kind of separating the world of, you know, algebra and regular programming, because now I have to kind of map my classes or my models, you know, my types onto vectors, where maybe I can kind of, you know, bring more of these concepts to the old school programming languages.
Yeah. Well, an R vector has a single type. R has a list, but that's something different.
Right.
One other thing I was going to mention is that missing values are intrinsic to R.
Okay.
So that's the difference between, say, like a C++ array. If you have a C++ array of doubles, you assume it has nothing but doubles in it. But since missing data is just a fact of life, that's fundamental to the language, that everything can be missing. And so there's the provision for dealing with missing data. You know, it's not some unusual thing. So like C# added nullable types.
Yes.
R has nothing but nullable types because you have to assume that your data can always be missing.
Okay.
In fact, it has different kinds of nulls.
Okay, because that was my next question, because SQL also deals with missing values, and we know all kind of, you know, the mess that creates.
Absolutely.
So how are missing values treated in, so if I, is there, like, for example, the one thing that always catches me in SQL, that null plus A is null, but if I do a sum of null and A, it's A. Is there something like that in R as well, or that they kind of treat it differently, whether you do it like, you know, summing a list or summing two values?
Yeah, I mean, there's things like that, but mostly there's the provision there for people to deal with it however they want, in that, your algorithm receives a vector, and then you can choose how to deal with missing values. You know, sometimes there's an obvious way to handle missing values, and sometimes there's not. It's very context dependent, but this is just sort of a universal flagging mechanism for that sort of thing.
And how does that work? Do you provide a callback, or how do you specify what to do when there's a missing value?
The library provider has to decide that, because, like I said, it depends very much on context. So, you know, if one measurement is missing, does that mean I just have to throw out that row of my table, or can I still take advantage of the values that are not missing? Well, it depends on context.
Okay. So another thing that, you know, where I think there's a big difference between, say, SQL and more imperative languages, is that in SQL, you're dealing always with collections. So if something goes wrong or something is missing, you cannot just draw an exception because you kind of want to continue to compute. Is that kind of a similar feeling here in R? You know, if you want to kind of, you know, go and munch over a big you know, matrix or something, you cannot just, like, if you're multiplying in the middle, throw an exception and say, you know.
Yeah. So R was designed for interactive data analysis, EDA. And for that reason, there's a big emphasis on convenience more than, say, safety. So, yeah, you don't want to throw an exception if something you don't know how to handle. Yeah, it's like a shell language. You know, in a shell, you'll tolerate some things you wouldn't you wouldn't tolerate in application language. R is more like a shell language for statisticians, for better or for worse. For better, if you're doing exploratory data analysis. For worse, if you're trying to write an application in R, where something that you would hope would throw an exception is just okay, and they make the best of it.
And is that interactivity, is that also one of the reasons that people like it so much? Because that seems to be another thing where, you know, if you look at R, people kind of always seem to be kind of very happy with the interactive nature, kind of, you know, scripting more or less, kind of typing a little bit, visualizing it.
Yeah. Well, I guess what people like there is everything's in one package, batteries included. So if you're doing this kind of work, you don't want to say, oh, now I'm going to plot something. Let me set a reference to my plotting library. Like, I'm doing something extraordinary that I need to stop the action and, you know, go do something else. So by default, all that's in one big namespace in R.
Yeah. Yeah, I sometimes wonder why that, you know, the reason that people are, that you, people use R is because of that interactivity. Whereas if you use like C++ or C#, you always have to kind of do the, you know, edit, compile, run. So the kind of turnaround, there's a lot more noise, you know, before you can kind of see your result.
Yeah. Well, and that gets back to this querying thing. Like, well, you know, why does R have its own kind of query filter mechanism? You know, we have a structured language for queries, right? Why not use that? Well, one way it's different is you're usually working with one table. You're not joining a bunch of tables. You have one data set, typically. And you're exploring things. So, I wonder, you know, if we throw this out, what happens? I wonder if we do this. So you're creating a query on the fly. And if it takes more than 2 seconds to create that query, you lose your train of thought.
Yes.
So you don't have time to say, select from where, you know. It's very, that's where this terse syntax for doing very quick on the fly queries is helpful.
And sometimes you also see when people do R that they kind of combine it with Excel. So they kind of, you know, they move back and forth. Is that something that you see as well, or?
I don't see people doing that, but it makes a lot of sense.
Okay, yeah, well, the book that I have on R kind of, you know, kind of,
the R book, maybe?
I got it like at the thrift store, so
yeah, okay.
it's still a good book, but they kind of go and kind of move back and forth between Excel and R.
Right.
Then can you say a little bit more about, like, you know, where you know, when I look at your blog, you often have, like, you know, you find super interesting things, you know. So what blogs do you read, or where do you find your information?
Let's see. Well, that's a good question. You know, I follow some interesting people on Twitter. I listen to some interesting podcasts. Have some good RSS feeds. on the spot, I just can't think of.
Okay, that's fine. So, but that's great, because, you know, people just have to go to your blog, and then they kind of, you know, you aggregate all that things.
Yeah.
Now, if somebody wants to learn, you know, learn to how to kind of, you know, become fluent in this new world of statistics and so on, what would you recommend them to do? You know, what is there anything, you know, it's like if you have an old school programmer that's kind of, you know, trained in, you know, say basic or, you know, like regular imperative programming, and they want to move to the new world of statistical computing.
Okay, well, I guess it depends on how deep you're into it. Drew Conway and John Miles White just wrote a new book, Machine Learning for Hackers.
Okay, yes.
So this is very much hands-on. Let's download a data set and play with it and try to discover something. And you know, he's not going to get into probability models and integrals and technical details. It's very much what the title says. It's for hackers. So if that's your entrance to this kind of world, then that's a good book. If you're interested more in really understanding what's going on, probability and the, the Bayesian models and that sort of thing, I'd have to think harder about what a good entry point is for that.
But maybe you can kind of write that up. But one thing there is, like, you mentioned something interesting, like machine learning for hackers.
Yeah.
My feeling with machine learning is that it's still in its early phase, so there's a lot of details that you have to know, or that kind of seep through. But in order to really use it, I'm not sure that you need to know all those things. It's the same thing as, like, when you use the CLR, say, do you need to know everything about the JIT and the machine instructions and calling conventions? No, you can kind of abstract from that. Is that the same with machine learning, where you can say, here's a library, and I really don't have to know all the details about distributions and means and variance and things like that? Or are you kind of then shooting yourself in the foot?
No, not at all. But there's sort of two phases. There's exploration and confirmation. Okay. For exploration, anything goes. If you say, I downloaded this data set, I did the following dubious operations on it, and this voodoo, and that like that, and I discovered that people who buy diapers buy beer. This is the kind of thing that Walmart wants to know, And then you can say, well, regardless of how you came up with this idea, maybe you saw it in a crystal ball, maybe it came to you in a dream or whatever, somehow you have reason to believe that diapers are correlated with beer purchases. Now let's test that.
Okay.
Now you're in a different world where now you need to know some more about probability and statistics so you don't fool yourself maybe by seeing a coincidence or whatever. So I would say, as long as you don't have too much confidence in what you've discovered, then you don't really have to be so anal retentive about all the theory and so forth. You can, boldly experiment and, see what you find.
Yeah. And so another thing, like, for example, if you look at the kind of the Bayesian models, and then, people also then kind of, simplify that because they say, that's too hard to compute. Are there kind of other things where, where you can say, look, this is the, in theory, this is the kind of real precise answer, but in practice, we can kind of, fudge a little bit around the edges.
Yeah.
To maybe get, like, an easier, computation, and B, to kind of easier to understand it, where there's kind of less dependence, like, where you assume that things are independent instead of dependent. Or are you, again, shooting yourself in the foot? Those are kind of things where, as an like an old school programming language guy, I'm always kind of afraid, right, when I make these assumptions, and maybe the results are wildly different.
Well, again, it's the exploration versus confirmation. And statisticians do the same thing when they think they're being all careful and like that, but they're really trying a bunch of stuff. And I guess there's a nice, there's a refreshing honesty about machine learning. Like, we don't pretend that we're being all careful about this. We're exploring a data set. And there's something refreshing about that.
Yeah, and also, I don't know, I mean, maybe this is, like, really philosophical, but Like when you have to, how do you ever know that two things are really, like, probabilities are really independent? Because, maybe, the fact that I'm throwing a coin, raises the temperature in the room, and now, that might influence something else. And so people kind of, I think, already kind of, fudge a little bit with these things.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. But maybe it doesn't matter.
Yes.
I mean, why are you doing this in the first place? We're trying to find what sells more beer. Well, regardless of how you came up with your idea, let's test it.
Yes.
And, sort of like Feynman, he would say, what's the answer to every scientific question? Let's do an experiment.
and so, like in your own work, so What kind of questions are you kind of trying to answer? What are the problems you're trying to solve?
Right. So one of the main things, I'm working for a cancer center.
Yep.
So the big picture is we're trying to find out how to more effectively treat cancer. So what does that mean? When it comes to the statistics, it means using adaptive models. You know, how can we treat the N plus first patient based on everything we've learned from the first patients? So, you know, these models of learning as we go, adapting as to take advantage of the information that we have. So a lot of my work is in methods for carrying out these experiments. So how are we going to make dose decisions in this trial? Or how are we going to determine whether this looks like it's not promising, it looks like it's worse than standard of care, so let's stop.
Okay, yeah.
In, you know, at a high level that sounds easy. Oh, if things look bad, we'll stop. Well, can we be a little more precise? You know, what does look bad mean?
Yes.
You know, so we come up with different proposals. Well, here's an idea, here's a model, let's use this. Well, we don't just run over to the hospital and use it. As soon as we have an idea, we simulate it. So we say, okay, using this decision-making rule, what if the state of nature is this? And we see how it works. What if it's this other thing? And you know, you try to kick it around. You know, how does this work in a diverse set of scenarios? And you know, if it works better than other things, then we say, oh, well, looks like we have a winner here.
And something, there was like an interesting article I read recently about some scientist at MIT that kind of videoed, like, you know, the development of his child from birth to, don't know, to see how they kind of learn to speak. But that made me think, like, for example, with things like, you know, cancer or health, it's like, I mean, when you kind of get sick, maybe there's like, you know, we don't know kind of your history, right? So
that's
what
right.
If we would measure kind of, you know, more things about, you know, if we would put our bodies full of sensors or our environment full of sensors, would that help? Or would that be kind of only invasive and privacy, but, you know, not really help?
Well, let me ask a more familiar question, more maybe is, well, what if we sequence your whole DNA?
Yes.
So instead of taking your temperature, you know, we take a blood sample and we say, okay, here's, you know, the 4 billion base pairs that make up your genome. You know, what can we make of that? Well, so far, not so much. You know, 10 years since we've sequenced the human genome, it hasn't been as useful as we'd hoped. Because when you ask thousands of questions, you can get a few false answers just looking at noise. The whole personalized medicine thing is a lot harder than it sounds. You know, in theory, we just say, well, look, these people responded to this therapy and these people didn't. What's different about them?
Yeah.
Well, you measure 30,000 variables and you'll find some variables that are different between the two of them, but maybe they're not causal.
Yeah. Although, but sometimes when you know, when I go to the hospital and then you have to kind of, it's like always kind of weird that you still have to fill in this kind of, you know, yellow paper form, you know, that you have filled in like, you know, 500 times before.
Sure.
And it asks questions like, you know, that, I mean, how do we know that those are the most relevant questions? And usually I don't even remember. It's like, when was the last time that you kind of had surgery? It's like, well, maybe that's kind of my Alzheimer moment. There's like, oh, is that like 2001 or 2000? Or is that surgery or not? So I don't know, it's like, is there a way to kind of more streamline that, where we're asking the right questions and maybe kind of, you know, record the right information? Or and I wouldn't mind kind of, you know, having like a microchip kind of just injected in my skin, you know, if I could kind of, you know, eliminate all the paperwork.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's just a challenge. With more data, you know, you might discover something. Like, you know, everybody who, you know, who has this disease is somebody who's been swimming in the afternoons. So, you know, afternoon swimming causes this. You know, when you're lucky, you know, when you're lucky, there's a smoking gun.
Yeah.
And, you know, that happens sometimes. Yeah. Or, you know, more seriously, you know, women who have this mutation in breast cancer respond to this treatment. That's the ideal scenario.
Yeah.
You hope to find something like that. But you also find a lot of false positives.
Yeah.
You know, with more data, you know, I guess the Spider-Man thing, with great power comes great responsibility.
Yes.
With great data comes a great amount of false conclusions.
Yes, and in medicine, isn't also a big problem like false negatives, when you say, oh, you know, you're safe,
absolutely,
but when you're not safe?
Absolutely. Well, like with the FDA, you know, their charter is safety. Well, you know, yeah, we want them not to approve poisonous drugs. But if you're a cancer patient, you know, you're dying of cancer, you roll the dice more, right? You know, so there's a public health cost to being too cautious to approve drugs. So, and the FDA knows this, and they've become more responsive to that, but they're walking a tightrope, you know.
So going back to technology, so like when you're crunching over this data, do you is it really crunching? Are you kind of crunching over terabytes, or is it like how big is the are the data sets that you're working on?
Right. There are people working on very large data sets. Most of my work is dealing with simulated data.
Okay.
So my data set is a handful of parameters.
Okay.
I have the privilege of making up my data.
Yeah.
So I say, you know, if this is the state of nature, what happens? And I simulate it 1,000 times or whatever. But the people working in bioinformatics, you know, they're working with DNA sequences or microarray data, where, you know, they're working with, you know, larger data sets.
But that's the thing is, like, you know, like if you look at a lot of the R programs too, to go back to that, is they often they're experimenting not with kind of, you know, terabytes of data, right? It's and so how is again, I mean, this is like my complete ignorance, right? So if you make conclusions about like something that kind of, you know, fits, you know, like in a spreadsheet or in your kind of in memory, how do you know that your conclusions are still relevant when you're kind of, you know, working over, you know, huge data sets? Don't you have to then have knowledge about statistics that, you know, this is like a representative sample or something like that?
Yeah, there is that. Brad Efron made a comment one time saying there are no large data sets. They're large collections of small data sets. You know, so a lot of big data, it's not as if we have exactly the data we want, you know, measured on millions of subjects. It's we have data that's kind of what we want on lots of subjects. So often it's not exactly the data you want, it's the data that's convenient to collect.
Yes.
So sometimes, you know, the data you really want collected on 200 people may be more relevant than a click stream on millions of people, but that doesn't directly address what you're trying to figure out.
And so if you you had a magic wand and you could kind of say, you know, I'm going to create my perfect tool for my work, how would that look like?
Ah, okay. Maybe we should bring the Julia people in, you know, because I kind of share their vision in that they want to create this programming language that gives you the, you know, the programming experience of a dynamic language, but it, you know, compiles down to C-like performance.
And so you mentioned dynamic language. Is that important for you? Is that also because you want to kind of experiment, that you don't want to start out by writing kind of, you know, types and so on, that you just want to get started quickly, or is it for efficiency? Or
yeah. Well, a lot of the work I've done has actually been C++ or C#. So, you know, I don't find it enormously burdensome to, you know, declare that an int is an int. But what I do find annoying, actually, like in older versions of C++, this has changed with C++ 11 and or even, yeah. But anyway, is declaring functions on the fly. You know, it's kind of like you kind of lose your train of thought if you say, oh, I have to declare a function, you know.
And
thing where you lose your context, go up and declare a function and come back and do what you're doing. So it's cool in like newer versions of C++, newer versions of C#, where you can, you know, declare a function on the fly. That's really nice. That's probably my favorite feature of dynamic languages, is this low ceremony for creating functions, closures.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
And looking forward to kind of, you know, reading more of your posts.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks.
Cheers.